Hello, everyone. I'm Rania Kalik, and this is Dispatches. Since October 7th, the Palestinian resistance has participated in countless battles against Israeli soldiers, exacting casualties that often go unnoticed, partly because the Israelis are reluctant to release details about their losses, but also because the horrors against civilians in Gaza are so shocking, it's hard to focus on the military side of things. But nearly 7 months into Israel's genocide, the Israelis have failed to achieve any of their military objectives, while the resistance continues to launch operations and unveil new weapons under the most difficult of circumstances. Much of this can be seen in videos released by the Al-Qassam Brigades, showing ambushes against invading Israeli soldiers, which have made the inverted red triangle seen in those videos a famous symbol of resistance. Joining me to discuss the battles, tactics, and weapons of the Palestinian resistance and more is John Elmer, a contributing editor at the Electronic Intifada. But before we jump into it, this is just part of this episode. The full episode is available to Breakthrough News members only. You can become a member at patreon.com/breakthroughnews. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's such a pleasure to have you on, especially about this topic, which has not received enough attention. I think there's so much that's been happening, obviously, since October 7th. We've been watching a genocide unfold. It's being live streamed. So people have been really horrified by the images of just horrific Israeli atrocities against civilians. Now everyone's captivated by the also horrific images of student protesters across the U.S. just facing down horrific levels of police violence and violence by like Zionist mobs. But over these last almost 7 months, there's also been something else taking place, which you focused on a lot at the Electronic Intifada, which is there is a war happening, right? Like a military war. And there is a collection of resistance groups in Gaza and outside of Gaza as well, that have been fighting battles, really, really fierce battles with the Israelis. And this has received much less attention because of all the other horrors I mentioned. So that's what we're going to focus on in this episode. I want to talk to you, I want to hear from you about the military resistance in Gaza and maybe also a little bit in Lebanon. So let's start there. Can you, I know it sounds silly to ask this question almost 7 months into a genocide, but just kind of lay out, when we talk about the Palestinian armed resistance in Gaza, can you break down who we're talking about? What's the collection of groups and who is it led by when it comes to military resistance to the Israelis in Gaza?
Yeah, well, the Hamas movement controls the Gaza Strip. They're the elected government in Gaza and in the West Bank and East Jerusalem as well. And their armed wing, the Qassam Brigades, over the last generation has really coalesced into effectively a national army. And so they operate on a national army level. They're beyond a guerrilla group at this point. And they function like an army, and they are still functioning like an army 6 months of ground war into the 7 month war. The first month was the aerial bombardment. But then there's another 10 other armed groups, primarily Islamic Jihad, Saraya al-Quds, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the Popular Resistance Committees. There's Fatah factions. The Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades are involved as a guerrilla group. And they function and coordinate with each other. But I think it's best to understand the resistance in Gaza as Qassam being a national army and approaching the fight that way. And that happens through its leadership, through its organization, the way it's structured. They are structured like a formal army, and they also have a weapons development program. And that's a program that's been going on for 25 years at least, in real full-fledged weapons production. And we're talking like all levels, research, development, testing, and then putting the weapons into service. And they have done that, building that weapons industry is what has allowed what we have seen for the last 6 months of the ground war to happen, because they have stores of weapons despite living under siege, blockaded in the Gaza Strip with no ability to reach the outside world and very little ability for the outside world to reach them. So the building up of the national army and the creation of a weapons development program to feed that army, to put a gun, to put a weapon, to put a rocket, a mortar, a hand grenade into the hands of every fighter was a program that the Qassam Brigade started really in earnest in the Second Intifada in the early 2000s. Under Adnan Al-Ghul, who was the founder of the weapons program, for the Palestinians. And the other groups participate in that as well. But it's run overall by the Qassam Brigades, by Hamas. And that weapons industry is really the key to the armed groups in Gaza. And so, you know, we hear talk about homemade weapons in Gaza, and it gives you this sort of sense that they're just slapdash. But it couldn't be further from the truth. They have used the engineering skills of people in Gaza to apply that to a weapons industry and really do research, development, and try to perfect with precision these weapons. Lots of times they're copies of other weapons. Lots of Soviet weapons are copied. But many of them are built by the Palestinians themselves, their engineering units. And of course, Hamas is deep into the sciences and engineering. And they've applied that to the armed struggle and to the liberation movement. And it's really, it's what's, I mean, also to say, they also built a tunnel apparatus. The Qassam Brigades has a massive tunnel apparatus under the Gaza Strip. And so these things have all come together, and we've really seen it over the last 6 months, because the fighters are able to move around through the tunnels. They're able to be armed, apparently, with an unlimited supply of weapons. We haven't seen any indication that they're running low on weapons, which is a surprise to most military analysts who didn't follow closely. They believed that the weapons were imported and they would eventually run out. But that's not the case. So the tunnels and the weapons industry, combined with the creation of a national army under the Qassam Brigades, has really allowed what we've seen and what the world has seen. If they're looking for it, if you're in the English language media, it's almost entirely absent. But the Qassam Brigades and the other groups as well, but primarily the Qassam Brigades, they have embedded within their fighting units an information operations element. They have videographers that are part of the teams. They are part of the reconnaissance teams. They're part of the squads that go out to carry out certain actions. They're embedded completely with them. And so we have seen just unbelievable footage. The first footage we thought was unbelievable, and then it's been getting better and better throughout the war. The complexity of their attacks have gotten better. Their videography has gotten better. And of course, there's a long tradition of this. Hezbollah, of course, started this kind of video taping your recordings and haunting the Israelis with them. So the Palestinians learned from that, just like Hezbollah learned from the Palestinians. That's been a give and take over the last, 40 years or so in those two movements. And so, I think the way to understand Gaza right now is as a national army, and Israel's attempting to defeat that national army, and they haven't been able to do that. But were they to be able to do that, then the Qassam Brigades would just fall back into being a guerrilla group that can also not be defeated. And so they've made this layered defense of Gaza. We don't know all of this. We didn't know all this stuff before the war. They don't give us the number of their weapons. They show us the research and development, but they don't say we have X number of weapons in our stocks. And so it's been amazing to see for, 7 months under the most brutal crimes that we're watching, for the fighters to be able to continue fighting, and just for the people in Gaza in general to be able to keep doing what they do. I mean, Abu Obeida, the spokesperson, said You know, you're never going to defeat a country whose children are the ones who teach the adults about strength. And I think anyone who's watched this conflict knows that the kids are just the pillar of this struggle. And these kids are watching this brutality and they're watching the heroics of their own people. And I don't think that this is something that Israel can come back from. The layers of this are really a problem for Israel long term.
Yeah, there's so much in there I want to unpack. But one thing I'd like to pivot to real quick is just the Israeli side of things. You know, Israel, obviously, we know has killed, the official number, I think now, is like 34,000 Palestinians in Gaza, though we all know it's much higher than that, given that there's people under the rubble. I'm not even sure how the system in Gaza is still able to count those who've been killed. But tens of thousands of people have been killed in Gaza, half of them children. Gaza's infrastructure has been largely demolished across the Gaza Strip by the Israeli military. Israel is really, really good at flattening buildings and at killing civilians. However, militarily speaking, has Israel achieved any of its objectives? And this is not to take away from the fact that the destruction is immense. I mean, there aren't words to describe it. I'm not trying to sit here and say that, like, oh, no, like, Israel's losing necessarily, but militarily, Israel says it's destroyed all of these Hamas battalions. They claim there's like a couple left in Rafah, and then they're just done. They've destroyed Hamas. But we still see Hamas firing at Israel from all the parts of Gaza the Israelis claim to have conquered. So I'll go back to, I guess, what I originally asked and let you answer it, which is, has Israel achieved its military objectives in this, I'll be generous and call it a war instead of a genocide for this moment?
Yeah, I mean, it's both. It's a war and it's a genocide. I think, no, Israel hasn't achieved any of its objectives, and Israel would be the first to tell you that. They didn't return their prisoners. They haven't defeated Hamas. They haven't destroyed the administration of Hamas. And at the beginning, they said they were going to destroy the idea of Hamas for future generations. Like, these kind of absurd goals for the war were just, they haven't been reached. And Israeli society knows they haven't been reached. They're leaving their prisoners. Presumably, they're just going to leave their prisoners to die in Gaza. So none of their military objectives have been accomplished. But like you said, they've eliminated the education system. They've eliminated literally the healthcare system. They dismantle the hospitals as their primary military objectives. They've destroyed and killed all the fighters' families. You know, they've destroyed enormous portions, depending on which satellite data you're counting, anywhere from 55% to 75%, some places more. Total destruction. And of course, they have billions and billions of dollars in surveillance and aircraft, tanks. And so they can destroy. They can destroy a lot. And the Palestinian fighters have been fighting bravely. And there's obviously a consequence to that. But there's no indication in any of the videos that we've seen of any of the large-scale toll on the resistance that Israel claims. Israel claims to have killed more than 10,000 fighters. There is absolutely no evidence of that from the Israelis. There's none from the Palestinians. The number, we don't know the number. Hamas isn't saying its number because it's not identifying its fighters that are killed, because Israel's just killing their families. And not just their families, right? Everyone that lives in the building with their families. So Israel's objectives are revenge and basically hatred. They hate the Palestinians so much that that October 7th gave them an opportunity to carry out this kind of fantasy that they've had for, you know, a number of generations, to destroy the Gaza Strip. They wanted to take over the Gaza Strip and live there. The Gaza Strip is beautiful. It's a Mediterranean coastal area. You know, you hear the Israelis talk about trying to make it a new Singapore or whatever like this. So the Israelis had designs on Gaza, and the resistance that we're talking about drove the Israelis out of Gaza after the second Intifada. And so this was kind of a revenge mission for Israel. Israel invaded in 2014. And they were humiliated in Shajaiya. The ground war only lasted minutes, and they were smoked and had to retreat. And so they've been kind of waiting for this opportunity when they've had, you know, when the, like the shackles, if you will, that what we thought were shackles of the Western, you know, Western rules-based order or whatever that would keep them in check. Now that that's completely off them, they're carrying out a revenge mission that doesn't show any signs of destroying. It doesn't, there's no sign that they have destroyed these battalions that they're saying. These are military terms. They call them combat ineffective if they have 30% of their fighting force depleted. And so they'll say that that battalion is gone now because it's only 70% functioning. But that is just not how war fighting works. It's not how battalions work. Military organization like Qassam, they replace their leaderships. They have a hierarchy. They have a way of moving new people into positions when fighters die. It's for sure costly to fight a war, a ground war, for 6 months. I'm sure there's been significant losses in the Qassam brigades and the other armed wings, but nothing like Israel is suggesting. Israel is carrying out a propaganda campaign that we've seen at all levels of this. And one of them is to have counting stats to constantly say, you know, we've killed 10,000, we've killed, you know, they just went up by 100. They go up by 100 all the time. We killed 100 fighters on this day. We killed 100 fighters on this next day. And they count like that with no indication that that's true. The only indications of mass casualties have been of innocent civilians who have nothing to do with anything. And then Israel targets the ability for you to count that and to understand what's the cost on the civilians, because they destroy the civil defense gear that would dig people out. They destroy the hospital that would count the civilians. And then for on Israel's side, they lie about their casualties. Mm-hmm. They have a complete censor, a total military censor on all news related to the war. They have spokespersons in every single hospital in Israel, controlling information coming out of those hospitals. We see on videos clear kills on video. There's no discrepancy about that. And then there's no casualty report from the Israelis. So they lie about the Hamas toll, and then they lie about their toll, undercounting their toll and wildly overcounting the Hamas toll. But let me just say, if they did kill 10,000 Hamas fighters, there's more than 40,000 Qassam fighters. There's 10 other armed groups that have, 10,000 or more fighters. So even if they were saying 10,000, which I don't believe is even close to true, I wouldn't even be surprised if it was less than half of that. You're not destroying a movement like that. That's not how it works. And then you also have every child in Gaza watching this happen and wanting to be a fighter more than any, you know, they all want to be fighters, journalists, and doctors, because that is their war. And they see that every day. They live it. You see the six-year-old kids going out for the food deliveries. You grow up fast in Gaza. And these kids are all going to be want to be fighters for the heroic resistance that they see every day. So there's no chance that Hamas is being destroyed. If anything, Hamas is being put to levels of popularity that it's never seen before. All over the Arab world, all around the world, you can even see it in the students, the student demonstrations, that the resistance is inspiring people all over the world from this tiny besieged enclave that has been blockaded for two decades. Nobody leaves Gaza. The kids have never seen a Jew before in their life. Until the invasion happened, they had never seen a Jew in their life. That's the reality of kids living in Gaza under a blockade. So there's nothing like Israeli accomplishments. And that's why Israel's in a strategic bind within their own country, right? Their government, their government doesn't want to get their people back. They don't want to have a prisoner exchange, which would release thousands of prisoners, Palestinian prisoners. And so we're just literally watching them let their people die day by day rather than a reasonable prisoner exchange and a diplomatic solution that would get them out, Israel, out of this war, that would end the war with Hezbollah in the north, that might allow their abandoned settlements in the north and the south to return back home. All of these things are very far down the line from a victory. There's not going to be an Israeli victory. There wouldn't be one if they opened a war with Hezbollah either, even more so. And so Israel needs a diplomatic solution to get out of this, but they're just wholly incapable of it right now. And the entire society is just gripped by this revenge, as if what happened on October 7th was the worst thing that any human can imagine, and any response to that is legitimate. It's insanity. It's national insanity. And it's difficult to see how Israel comes back from that. It's hard to see when you've had, you know, at this point, hundreds of thousands of their soldiers, at least 100,000 have served in Gaza. They've made these TikTok videos where they're destroying houses and dancing and acting like idiots, dressing up in women's clothes, you know, for women who are put on a death, like almost literal death march from their houses in Gaza City with their children walking foot over foot down to the south. And then their homes are robbed. Their money is stolen. Israel brags about $7.5 million stolen in cash from homes in Gaza. That's how disconnected they are from reality, that they believe that telling people that we've stole money from people's homes and we're putting it in the Bank of Israel, cash, we forfeited it and put it into the Bank of Israel. Whose house? They don't know whose house they're in. It's not like a police forfeiture of criminal money. This is just going from house to house in a civilian city and stealing people's money and being proud of that, listing that as an accomplishment, attacking hospitals and listing that as an accomplishment. They don't just attack the hospital quietly. They said when they attacked Shifa that's a model for future raids. Then, of course, we saw it in Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis where they did the same thing, making mass graves, layers of mass graves. Things that these are going to be war crimes trials, probably for decades to come. They have made such a digital footprint of their crimes. And it's almost unspeakable. At this point, I don't even know what to say. I don't know how you describe an army whose only military objectives that they have achieved is destroying hospitals. They don't go in and destroy command centers of Hamas. They don't go down into the tunnels and fight in the 500 miles of tunnels under Gaza.
Because they would lose.
And so they attack the hospital, because people didn't defend the hospitals, because Palestinians didn't believe that they needed to militarize their hospitals in order to protect patients.
There's a good argument to be made that actually Palestinian hospitals do need to be defended with weapons against a genocidal army. And that's what I want to ask you about that. When it comes to what they did at Shifa, and then later they did the same thing at Nasser Hospital, you called it the battle for Shifa Hospital. And like you said, no, there aren't command centers under hospitals. However, they did manage to basically disembowel this hospital. They destroyed it. They demolished it. They tied up patients and executed them. They killed children. They killed doctors. Tell us what happened at Shifa Hospital and why you framed it as a battle.
Well, I framed it as a battle because the Qassam Brigades and Sarai al-Quds defended the hospital. And that was the first time that we saw them do that. In the previous raids, they didn't do that, because to defend the hospital cuts the hospital off from people accessing it. It gives the Israelis the go-ahead to destroy the hospital. And so they rationally didn't set up installations in the hospitals. And then Israel decided that they're going to, one by one, from the north to the south, dismantle each and every hospital on the way through Gaza. And then they did that all the way down to Khan Yunis. And then they went back up to Shifa and re-raided Shifa. And the second raid of Shifa, The resistance defended it and fought battles out on the outskirts of the hospital. The Israelis took significant casualties in order to carry out a massacre of hospital patients, because the people who are in Shifa are too injured, too maimed to leave. Everyone else who could leave left. You saw footage of people pushing hospital beds down dirt roads. And we've seen people in the Shifa mass graves with their hospital, like with their IVs still attached to them. People who had broken arms that had the metal, the metal rods in them, they're just ripped off the bed, and they're executed with single gunshots and then bulldozed and buried in a mass grave. I called it the Battle for Shifa Hospital because for the 30 hospitals they dismantled before going back to Shifa, there was a question of, I think they have to do this. They have to defend these hospitals. They have to fight outside of
No one else was going to do it. The international community certainly wasn't going to do it.
And they're going to kill everybody. They're not going in there to hold the hospital. Israel wasn't going room to room to make sure everything was okay, and facilitating electricity and, you know, a military raid on a hospital, if you want to justify it and go room to room saying you're looking for a certain person. That's not what Israel's doing. Israel's blowing up entire wings of the hospital, killing patients, doctors, elderly people, children, and burying them in a mass grave and bulldozing over the mass grave. And in a hospital like Shifa, there's actually three layers of mass graves in Shifa over the course of the 6 months. And so I wanted to draw, all I do is follow what the resistance videos tell us. I'm following the battle reports. And as soon as they started defending around Shifa Hospital, it became a battle. And that's a term that I only use in certain circumstances to give what gets called a battle. I've been careful about that, but Shifa was absolutely a battle. And it's so deranged by the Israelis that they're willing to let their people die in tanks, in fiery coffins, in order to carry out for a couple extra days massacres inside of a hospital. And then they burned the neighborhood. They just destroyed the neighborhood. They burned it down. They showed TikTok videos taking flares and throwing them into people's houses where there's injured people who couldn't be evacuated, people burned to death. It's really sick and really sick what we're seeing. It's hard to even know what to say about something like that. Whatever I could say about Shifa doesn't even scratch the surface of it. And then now our friends have access to Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis, where the same thing happened. And they're just getting in there over the last few days and showing us what's in Nasser Hospital. And it's brutal too. They completely dismantled the place, and that was their intention. They dismantled it before they left Khan Yunis. Their objective was, we didn't destroy this hospital enough in the first raid on the Khan Yunis Hospital. So we're going to go back again. And if it costs our soldiers' lives, we don't care, as long as we can kill doctors, maimed patients, and make Palestinians believe that they'll never be able to set up an administrative government, which is what they're doing, because a hospital does have administrative functions in it. Right. It makes sense for police to be in and out of a hospital. It makes sense for interior ministry people to be in and out of a hospital, government officials to be in and out of a hospital, especially when it's the only place with power and water and internet connection. It's a government facility. If you went to any hospital anywhere in the world, you would find government officials interacting with patients. It's a very normal thing. But Israel says that any governmental, any municipal service is Hamas, and Hamas needs to be defeated. And so they want to defeat every layer of Palestinian society, because Hamas is a government, an elected government that runs a functioning society under siege. So the schools, the hospitals, any kind of municipal services, the Israelis destroyed the Palestinian Legislative Council. Right. So you can't have a parliament. And so that's their goal. Their goal is to destroy Hamas as an administrative apparatus and as a military apparatus. And it's easier to destroy the civilian apparatus because they can go into Shifa Hospital and attack people who can't fight back.
It's really unbelievable. I mean, look, I haven't studied military history, but is there like a precedent for dismantling hospitals as a part of your war, your policy of war? I know that hospitals have been targeted before. Like I know the U.S. targeted a hospital in Afghanistan and then apologized for it. I mean, who knows if they meant to do it or not. Probably they did, but it wasn't like some systematic, and this is, by the way, not to say the U.S. is great or better than Israel. It's not, but there wasn't like a systematic policy of like going around and destroying hospitals. Maybe there aren't that many hospitals to destroy in Afghanistan. I don't know. But all that said, like, is there a precedent for what Israel's doing in this context of like what you just described?
Not in our Western military examples. In Iraq and Afghanistan, hospitals were shelled, they were bombed. Like you say, they often would say it was an accident or there was a fighter on the edge. They also took hospitals, like the Marines went in and took hospitals, but they allowed the hospital to function. They went in looking to clear out if there was any fighters in the hospital, and then they moved on. They didn't. They didn't kill people in their hospital beds, the war crimes of the American Empire are significant. And so we're not saying that we're saying that these crimes are worse than that. It is saying a lot. They destroyed, you know, two societies, the Americans. Two societies in the Afghanistan and Iraq wars, and they were brutal. But in the particular example of hospitals, I don't think there is an example of that in our governments, Western governments, to massacre and have mass graves where they're pulling hundreds of bodies out of mass graves. We're seeing things that I don't think that we have seen before.
I want to go back to the Palestinian resistance, but I also want to broaden this out a little bit. You mentioned Lebanon, Hezbollah, the settlements in the north. Now Hezbollah's videos aren't as exciting as the Qassam videos. It's much more about weapons, right? Like unveiling weapons. Because there's not the same sorts of battles like in face-to-face kind of ambushes because the Israelis have not invaded Lebanon. That said, the Israelis definitely have an appetite for invading Lebanon. I don't think they actually could if they tried. We saw what happened in 2006. But can you talk a bit about what that would look like? Like, what are they up against when it comes to Hezbollah? Obviously, Hamas and the various other factions, they're operating out of a death camp that is surrounded. Hezbollah is in a country and they have a lot more depth, whether it's in Lebanon or Syria as well. They have a lot more depth to work with. They have far superior weapons because they're not surrounded the way that Hamas is. So a war with Hezbollah would look a lot different. I think the Israeli military brass is well aware of that. So can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, Hezbollah is many years ahead of the Palestinian resistance in this type of weapons procurement and development. And like you said, they're not isolated. They have a land corridor. They have allies that they can trade weapons with. Their fighters can leave and go and train on these weapon systems outside of the country in a way that Palestinians can't. And they've built up a significant arsenal that we haven't seen yet. We know that they didn't need that significant arsenal in 2006. Israel couldn't even get their ground invasion up into Bint Jezbel, right? They couldn't even get to the place to fight to get videos of close quarters combat, which is what you're saying is the difference between Gaza, is we see the fighters right up close because of the ground invasion. The videos that Hezbollah has shown us throughout this war are incredible videos, but they're at a distance. They're at a distance and they're using more high-tech weaponry and using it very effectively. And the idea that the Israelis are going to carry out a ground war in Lebanon, I don't want to be making predictions, but the army can't take Khan Yunis. This army, the paratroopers brigades, their special forces brigades, their best fighters, 4 months in Khan Yunis, they couldn't take Khan Yunis. They couldn't take any objective in Khan Yunis except for a hospital. There's courageous fighting with significant weaponry, homemade weaponry. That's just a completely different story if you're talking about invading Lebanon. In fact, I would say if there was an open war between Hezbollah and Israel, the fighting will probably be in the Galilee. The odds that Hezbollah comes for the Galilee, I see those as higher than columns of Israeli tanks that were built for urban warfare climbing the side of a mountain to get up into the villages in Lebanon. And I think the Israelis see that too. They've been worried about Hezbollah coming down into the Galilee, making the fight be inside Israel, not inside Lebanon, the same way that Qassam did on the 7th of October. To bring the fight inside the country of Israel is a complete paradigm shift for the way that these wars have been fought for Israel's occupation. Go back, you know, to the 1980s, Israel could do more or less whatever it wanted in the early 80s, late 70s. By the year 2000, they're running away from South Lebanon so fast, they're leaving their computers on and their helmets hung up, and people are watching them run down the hills. And when I was in Lebanon, people told me those stories of watching them run down the hills. And they told the stories of the tanks from 2006. They would point to the track and say, look at how far the tank got, because you could see the tank track coming up the hill and it didn't go into the village. There's a stop on it and it got disabled and dragged back down the hill, leaving these big scars down the hill. And people in South Lebanon, they loved it. They couldn't, these were paradigm shattering moments that Israel could never come back from. The defeat in South Lebanon in 2000 inspired the Palestinian uprising. The Palestinian uprising destroying Merkava tanks inspired Hezbollah in 2006. So these paradigm shattering moments are also piling on each other, in a way that I just don't see Israel doing that. I feel like that is really an existential war. The Israelis have been saying it's an existential war in Gaza, which I think is a bold move when you're losing that war to call it existential. Like, it makes you want to say, like, promise this is existential. But in Lebanon, it's real. It's real in Lebanon. Lebanon has the ability to precisely target all Israeli infrastructure, from its nuclear plants to its chemical plants to its offshore gas, to hit its air bases, to take its fighter jets down, to fire rockets at a rate that Israel's never seen, and not just Katyusha rockets. Heavy payload, accurate missiles that are directed and hit their targets. And we saw with Iran's attack from 1,500 kilometers away that Israel wasn't able to defend completely against that from half a continent away. Hezbollah's going to fire those from the hilltops, and they're going to hit army bases, air bases that are all over Israel. They can hit downtown Tel Aviv. They can make Tel Aviv an unlivable place within hours. If that's the war that Israel wants, Hezbollah is, of course, like, historically patient and don't escalate like that. And the Iranians were the same. The Iranians didn't send ballistic missiles at Tel Aviv. They sent them at desert air bases. But if the rockets were, the missiles were to become, to rain down on Tel Aviv, I don't know how long people would want to be living in Tel Aviv. I think Israel's in a little bit of a bind here, a big bind. And it's not clear how they're going to get out of it. Opening an open front with Hezbollah, I feel like verges on national suicide.
Yeah, indeed. And I mean, you know, it stands to be seen. You're right. I don't want to make big predictions either, because the Israelis can be quite irrational and unpredictable, but I'm not sure how suicidal they are. And that's not to say they wouldn't be able to destroy Lebanon. They absolutely have the air superiority to completely, like, 2,000 ton bomb demolish Lebanon across the board. There's no question about that. But Israel also has to deal on a diplomatic front when it comes to Lebanon with the fact that Lebanon's a country. And unlike Gaza, Lebanon has embassies. I mean, you know, they can't, they can carpet bomb big parts of Lebanon, but they can't, I mean, they could carpet bomb all of it, but then they're just going to piss off their allies too, because I don't know how happy the Europeans would be or Americans would be if their soft power arms across Lebanon were destroyed, including their embassies. That stands to be seen. However, like you said, these, you know, Hezbollah, Iran, they've sent the, you know, they're Iran with its missile attack that was very choreographed and, you know, a week in advance, basically told everyone they were going to do it. That was intended to send a message of their capabilities. Everything Hezbollah's done is strategically to send a message and not escalate into the bigger war. And I just want to show kind of a juxtaposition here, because I don't know how many people who watch my show are necessarily following along the videos, or if you've ever even seen these videos. So I just want us to show, like, a recent, and these are both videos you've tweeted out, a recent video from Qassam. Just kind of giving an idea of what they're putting out. And this, of course, has the red triangles, the inverted red triangle, which have become a quite famous symbol of resistance across the region these days.
Across the world. It's really remarkable.
Yeah. For those who are just listening, this is a Qassam mortar team versus IDF excavators and troop positions, establishing a corridor that divides the Gaza Strip to the U.S. Army PEER project, which we'll get to, by the way, in ways that you can't really comprehend if you're only listening, which is why you should go check this out on YouTube. But I'm just going to play part of this video. Those triangles. So this is the Hamas guy launching a rocket.
Yeah, and then we're seeing
they're hitting the excavators for those who are just listening.
Direct hit.
I like how they rewind and then This guy's making a statement about the resistance in Gaza.
Yeah, he's announcing where they are, that they're still here fighting, and he says what the target is, which is this Netzarim corridor.
And so these guys, by the way, so I'm just, I mean, we don't need to play the whole thing. It's like 2 minutes long. I encourage people, by the way, if you're not following along on the Telegram channels, to go follow John Elmer, because you have been basically, like, sometimes I honestly, like, I used to follow every single one of these videos, but it's been so overwhelming. I catch them actually on your Twitter account. You're always pointing out, oh, this is happening. And I think that's really important for people to follow along with. These videos are really well edited, first of all. As far as propaganda goes, very well done. It's keeping people also, like, knowing that the resistance is still fighting. Because, you know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, we wouldn't have had these videos to look to know what's happening, that these battles are even really taking place unless we hear about them. And then I just want to show a Hezbollah video to you, which you also posted recently, to kind of give an idea of, like, the Hezbollah style of video, which is different. They have, you know, the sort of opening Arab war music that you in the beginning.
Yeah, Hezbollah keeps a steady soundtrack for all the videos.
They really do. But have a much different feel, because, like we were talking, They were saying this is not face-to-face battles, or I mean, close-up battles. This is not an ambush. This is really just like kind of unveiling weaponry, showing what they're capable of. And what I'm about to show here, I'm just reading your tweet. It's Hezbollah versus an IDF Elbit Hermes 450 combat drone, which is an Israeli-made drone that does surveillance, also can carry out airstrikes, is used in assassinations. And this is, I mean, Hezbollah has on several occasions used surface-to-air missiles. They've downed these drones before. You said in your tweet, this is the second Hermes 50 kill, plus a 900 was down only in the past few weeks. So they're demonstrating their abilities here. Here's what it looks like.
Yeah, so this is the flagship Israeli drone. This is the sort of pride of Israel's Air Force. The drones that buzz over Gaza.
Yeah.
So Hezbollah gives you here the statistics, specs. These are killer drones.
And this is Hezbollah's view, by the way. Following and hitting. That's a hit. They're showing us the hit again. It's impressive.
And then we watch it tumble out of the sky.
Bye-bye, killer drone. All right, so that's the Hezbollah videos for anyone who hasn't seen them. But, you know, I think these are important to pay attention to because it's also a message to the Israelis and also to their own people. But this is demonstrating a capability that, like, if Israel does launch the big war on Lebanon, like, Hezbollah is just showing a tiny, tiny taste of what it can do.
Yeah. And that's been part of what they're doing is I actually haven't told us what that weapon is that has now downed at least three drones in the last 3 weeks. And these drones, of course, if you know, Israel's weapons industry, this is the sort of the crown jewel of their weapons industry. They sell them all over the world. They're considered, you know, one of the best, if not the best, one of the best drones in the world. The American MQ-9 Reaper drone is the best drone in the world, and Ansar Allah has downed three of those over Yemen, apparently using the same weapon, but we're not sure. Hezbollah hasn't told us. Nasrallah referred to it and gave his sort of like smirk about it, like everyone wants to know, because that video that we just watched, they actually edited the moment where the missile hit. Because they don't want us to see what kind of missile hit it. And then Nasrallah gives, you know, a smirk saying, you know, it's an unknown missile. And so there's all kinds of that. That's just a taste, like you said, it's just a taste of what these Hezbollah units have with strategic depth. They have many fighters, many units, you know, they're more prepared to go to war with Israel by far than Israel is to go to war with them. Israel is calling up, you know, they talk about their reserves and how great it is that they call up all these people, but they're calling school teachers away for, you know, one month of the year. Hezbollah has a professionalized army that are trained on these weapon systems, that are able to travel to Iran to train on the weapon systems during the research and development stage of these weapons. So it's not like a box comes and they open it and go like, oh, I guess
and
we got to learn
how to use it.
Yeah. You know, YouTube video to see how to use it. They're actually sending their fighters as part of their education to learn how to use these weapons. And so they come back and we're seeing them use them to great effect. They have a top attack anti-tank missile that is a missile that can fly up and down over covered, like it'll fly over a wall and hit something that is believed to be behind a wall and safe. And they got that weapon by capturing it in the July war in 2006, sending it to Iran. Iran reverse engineered it and made this weapon system that will be devastating to the Israelis in a ground invasion. We've seen them use it. We've seen Hezbollah use this. It's called the Almaz. We've seen them use it against positions, against tech equipment. And we've seen it a couple times against tanks, but it's a tank killer. And so the mechanized invasion of Lebanon by Israel will be met by this very sophisticated peer, near peer to the Israeli weapon. They're using an Israeli weapon system that is one of the pride weapon systems of Israel that the United States uses, the Spike missile. It essentially is a missile that you could drive after you fire it. So it allows the crew to fire it and then get away safely. You don't have to linger in the spot. And you can just steer it as if it's its own, effectively its own plane. And so you can take it up over a wall, right? Israel builds their bases on the top of the mountains, and then they build a high wall. This weapon can travel below the Iron Dome air defense system and then travel up and down and hit. And when you're talking about anti-tank warfare, those weapons are going to be devastating. To be able to accurately hit from it's called non-line of sight. So it means that the person who fired it doesn't need to be looking at the target. So you can fire it in a completely different direction, and then somebody takes over the flight and changes the direction and hits the tank from above where it's less armored. These kind of weapons, we've only seen little bits of them, but were they to be applied across the battle space in Lebanon, they're not going to win that war. And I don't think the Americans think that, which is why there's aircraft carrier strike groups floating off the coast. It's why they came immediately after October 7th. I mean, Israel needed all kinds of support after October 7th. They basically needed the world to mobilize for them from an attack by 1,000 fighters with homemade weapons coming out of Gaza. What happens when you have 20, 30, 50,000 Hezbollah fighters who have been training for decades and are skilled fighters? The Palestinians are skilled fighters. They just don't have the numbers, and they don't have what you rightly pointed out earlier, the strategic depth that allows just really to take your fighting to the next level. They're not a guerrilla group. Hezbollah is on par with many militaries, right?
So I want to ask you, given everything you've just said, there is this image of Israel that has repeatedly, I think, had holes punched in it, that it's this very, very strong country. It's like immunized by this bubble of protection. It's got the Iron Dome, right? Like, it's so hard to kill an Israeli soldier because they're all and these really strong tanks. And before the tank is the Iron Dome. And also, like, all these countries come to its aid with missile defense systems. And you can't ever defeat Israel. It's just too strong. I'm curious, when it comes to the Iron Dome, obviously it does work to a certain degree. How well does it work? And then just to kind of make this a bit bigger, how much is Israel reliant on the U.S.? Like, if the U.S. were to stop, it's not that it's going to happen, but if America, like, were to stop its weapons flow, like, because Israel's defense industry has this image of being so strong and so powerful, they can make their own weapons, they're all the top of the line, they sell to the whole world, on and on and on. So, like, how much is Israel actually dependent on the U.S. to win a war, or I shouldn't even say win, just to survive a war? And then how effective actually is the Iron Dome, in your opinion?
Well, the Iron Dome systems haven't been targeted. Hezbollah's begun to target those systems and take them out. Those systems are finite. They don't have an unlimited supply of those systems. In a ground war with precision missiles, the goal would be to take out those units. So in how they'll defend in an open war with Lebanon is very in question. They have a massive missile defense shield. There's no question. Israel has piggybacked on the back of Cold War missile defense that started after World War II and has been, literally hundreds of billions of dollars invested in it. And Israel is, of course, the laboratory, right? People call it the laboratory because you can put those air defense systems and test them in Israel and see how they work. But these systems have limits. They can be flooded. They can't handle a massive barrage. And we've never seen that before. I mean, we saw it on October 7th when Qassam fired 5,000 rockets within the first few minutes. And many of those, the Iron Dome can't handle it. It gets overwhelmed by them. And then what we saw with Iran is you can send multi-tiered attacks. You can send slow drones to tie up the defenses and then sneak your bigger missiles through. So they're not able to be protected by their Iron Dome. I think the Iron Dome system is a little bit of a for their national project to feel safer. That they have an air defense system. The Americans always want to try these air defense systems out because they would use them if they work. And so I'm not sure that the Israelis could exist for more than a very, very short number of weeks without American help.
If you enjoyed this episode and want to hear the rest, you can access it by becoming a Breakthrough News member at patreon.com/breakthroughnews.